This is the English Heritage Podcast.
Hello, and thanks for joining us for your weekly podcast, Into England's Past. I'm Charles Rowe. We're here with new episodes every Thursday, so make sure you subscribe to stay up to date. Today, we're looking back 300 years to the 1720s and to the role of the rarest of survivals, an almost complete steelmaking furnace. For around 170 years, Derwent Coats Steel Furnace and the Derwent Valley were at the centre of the British steel industry, converting wrought iron into steel. Three centuries later, it's become part of an altogether different industry, heritage and tourism. And here to talk to us about the history of the site and how it's run today are properties historian Andrew Roberts.
Hello.
And volunteer manager Sophie Hearn.
Hello.
Well, thanks both of you for coming on. We'll get on to how you can plan a visit shortly with Sophie. But first of all, Andrew, could you describe where Derwent Coat is and how this location became central to British steelmaking?
Derwent Coat lies just to the south of the River Derwent in the quiet parish and district of Derwentside, near the small village of Hamsterley in County Durham. This perhaps doesn't shout industrial powerhouse. It's a woodland somewhat in the middle of nowhere. There are no major roads here in the early 18th century. And the site sits next to an unnavigable river. But the location is actually deceptively rich. The river means that there's water power available there. You're only about 10 miles southwest of Newcastle and therefore within easy reach of the large ports and the import and exports of the port. And you're in an area with everything that you might need for steel making. There's supplies of coal for fuel. The wooded countryside means that there's charcoal, which is vital to metalworking. And as a result, Derwent Coats, and indeed the wider Derwent Valley, swarms with industries, not just steel making, but also ironworks, mining and sword making.
You mentioned the river and water power there. Why were they important to the original forge which operated on the site?
So by 1719, we know that there was a very successful forge at Derwent Coat. It's there converting a high carbon cast iron into wrought iron that can be used to make things like fire grates for steam engines, axles for coal wagons. And it's producing in the mid 18th century, something in the range of 150 tons of iron per year, which is a very significant contribution to various industries. And the reason for this is that although the river is unnavigable at this point, its topography is really useful for the provision of power. And this really underpins all the activity at the site. So essentially, the forge sits on a plateau within the bend of the river. The river's been dammed just the west of the site, and then a system of waterways feeds water from the river into a mill pond, which is then used to drive a water wheel and power the machinery of the forge.
So it's all there for them, really, to create an industry.
Yeah, essentially, without this underlying power, there's really no point in being at Derwent Coat.
In the 1730s, steelmaking evolved by using what's called a cementation furnace, which is present at Derwent Coat. Now, what is a cementation furnace, for people who don't know?
Well, when we talk about the cementation furnace, that is the building that you will see if you go to Derwent Coat today. And the simple answer to your question is that a cementation furnace converts iron into steel. The more complex answer, for which I'll need something of a run-up, is that up until the end of the 19th century, steel, when we talk about steel, we're essentially talking about an alloy of iron and different amounts of carbon. So steel is roughly 1.5% carbon. And in order to make it, you have to do various different things to iron. You can either take cast iron, which is an alloy containing 3 or 4% of carbon, and you remove some of the carbon from it, or else you take wrought iron, which basically has no carbon, and you add the requisite carbon to it. Now, cementation essentially does the latter. You're adding carbon to iron. And the process is a batch process, and at the time, it's the most efficient means of producing steel on a comparatively large scale. So at Derwent Coat in the 1730s, with the construction of a cementation furnace, we have an operation that's really at the forefront of this important technological process that's going to be the mainstay of steel production in Britain for at least 120 years.
Isn't it quite an ancient technology? Where did it develop?
Well, steel making is an ancient technology, but cementation specifically has only been developed comparatively recently in the 16th century. And although the cementation process is known elsewhere in Europe as the English method, it actually originates in Germany before then being essentially brought to England and establishing itself, particularly in the Northeast and later in the Sheffield area in the 18th century. And the reason why it takes off in Britain is because Britain monopolizes the import of high quality wrought iron from Sweden. So like many countries, British iron, the iron ore that we have, is actually quite useless for cementation as it has impurities, particularly phosphorus. And when you make steel via cementation, it doesn't work if it has phosphorus in it. But the Northeast is able to import this much better quality iron from Swinnerton via Newcastle to be worked in the Derwent Valley. And this really propels the Northeast to the forefront of European steelmaking in the 18th and for most of the 19th century.
Ah, very interesting. And it helps that they're up in the Northeast there, being that little bit closer to the North Sea and Sweden and Scandinavia, effectively.
Yes, exactly.
That would have helped. Let's talk about the furnace itself then. How does it sit in the landscape and what does it look like, the actual building? It's quite an interesting shape, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the building itself is quite an odd one, actually. It's essentially three buildings, although it kind of looks as if it's one sort of cohesive building. You have the actual furnace itself, which is quite small. It's about 10 meters long, it's about 6 meters wide. It has a chimney, a conical chimney, about 10 meters tall. But inside, it's actually quite a complicated structure. You have a long hearth running the length of the building, and then you have a vaulted chamber above it and a system of flues built around and into that chamber. And then above that, you have the chimney where the gases from the furnace would vent. If you're having trouble sort of imagining what I'm describing here, it's probably best to maybe go and have a look on our website where you can see some pictures of it. And then you have the furnace, and then either side of the furnace, at either end of the hearth, you have these ancillary buildings, which essentially sort of clutch the furnace, where you can essentially do all of the sort of the ancillary activity that you need to do in order to make the steel.
So almost three blocks stuck together with this conical shape in the middle, which has its cone top cut off. That's kind of like what it looks like, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. The very top of the cone has been lost. It would have been a little bit taller than that when it was in operation.
Ah, right. Okay. Interesting. So let's talk about this process of cementation. This is where we get a little bit metallurgical. This is where the chemistry students really like to geek out. But can you tell us how it all works?
Well, I should point out that I was not one of those chemistry students. I gave up chemistry when I was 16 and focused more on history. Cementation involves a long period of heating wrought iron in close contact with carbon and sealed from the air to allow the chemical process to take place. So fixed within the furnace are these two chests of sandstone. They look a little bit like troughs. And basically those chests are packed with iron bars and charcoal, which provides the carbon, in alternating layers, and then sealed with a layer of sand to make them airtight. Mm-hmm. You then light a fire in essentially the grate below, and the flames and the heat are carried around the chest by the system of flues and into the chamber, reverberating off the roof of the vault. Then eventually the airs then are vented into the conical chimney. And it's quite a considerable operation. It takes 6 hours just to load, you know, the iron by sliding it in through small holes in the face of the furnace. Then you've got another 15 hours just to heat it to the requisite temperature, which is 1,100 degrees. And it's at this temperature that the carbon starts to diffuse into the iron, which is essentially turning it into steel. But you've got to keep it at this temperature for about 5 days and nights in order to complete the process. After that, you can't just take it straight out because it's still hot. You've got to allow it to cool for 6 to 10 days before you unload it. So the whole process takes around 2 weeks.
How big were the pieces of steel that were being produced then by this process of cementation at Derwentcote?
Well, they're probably about the interior length of the chests, so about 3.5 meters long. They're quite flat and quite thin, so about 7 or 8 centimeters wide and about 1 or 2 centimeters thick. And when it's completed, the steel that's produced is known as blister steel. And the real reason why it's known as blister steel is because it has these sort of distinctive little pockets on the surface caused by impurities in the iron reacting and producing carbon monoxide. And over the course of one firing, you're probably going to be producing about 10 to 14 tons of steel, giving you something in the region of upwards of 100 tons per year, depending on how many firings you do. You could produce maybe up to 200 tons. And in the 18th century, this is a considerable contribution to European production. So in and around the time that Derwentcote opened, there's only about 1,000 tons of Swedish iron being converted into blister steel in the entire country. And Derwentcote could conceivably, we don't have exact figures, be producing up to about 20% of national capacity.
That's remarkable. You mentioned at the start what this blistered steel was made into. Was it axles, did you say?
Well, the axles and things, that's what's being produced down by the river in the forge.
Okay. Up
just on the valley side, that's where you've got the cementation furnace. And this is a different process with a slightly different output. So the blister steel itself is absolutely useless. Okay, you might be able to get away with using it as a paperweight, but if you hit it with a hammer, you could fracture it. So it actually needs to be worked in a forge before you can use it for anything. It's also non-homogeneous. What I mean by that is that it has various different levels of carbon. It's not a consistent process. You don't have the same amount of carbon in each of the bars of steel. So the lower tempers, so those with the least amount of carbon, might be worked into cheaper, less important bits of metal, things like springs or cheap cutlery, whereas the higher tempers, more carbon, would be bundled together and forged down to produce layered, laminated, sheer steel. And this is sort of very sharp, potentially very sharp, very strong, and used by blade makers. So particularly in the production of agricultural implements such as scythes and shears and things like that.
Right. So there's several stages of production effectively.
Yes. So the cementation furnace is one part of this operation that's going on at Derwentcote. Because in theory, the forging into other forms of metal or into potentially also into some finished products could have been done either at the forge or elsewhere in the Derwent Valley.
I see. We mentioned that Derwentcote was this industrial site for around 170 years. What made it so successful? You've talked about, obviously, the landscape. It was in a perfect spot. It's in the northeast. It's got that connection to Sweden and the North Sea for the reception of the iron. But there are other things that make it successful, aren't there?
Yeah, I think the first thing to think about is risk-taking. Building the cementation furnace in the first place is really important. Taking a chance on this potentially new technology and seizing the opportunities presented to you by the fact that there's a market for this output. The owners of Derwentcote do show some attempts to keep the furnace at the cutting edge of steel production throughout the 170 so years of its production. There's some failed attempts to try new ways of making steel and some successful ones as well. So in the mid-19th century, another method comes along known as crucible steel. And a crucible furnace is inserted into the forge buildings down by the riverside. And this works with the cementation furnace in order to convert the blister steel into cast steel. And that's very important in keeping Derwent viable for the second half of the 19th century. I think the other thing to think about is quality. So the shear steel produced throughout the Derwent Valley is known collectively as Newcastle steel, and it's famed as being the best in Europe. So at Derwentcote, they are producing the raw resource in order to make this high quality product for which there is a demand, not only in sort of local markets, but in the wider world.
We've talked about the site, its attraction, its success. Obviously, though, to produce steel, you don't just need the owners, you need the workers. How many people worked at Derwent Coats? Also, where did they live?
Well, for the cementation furnace, you only technically need two people to run it, a steelmaker and their apprentice. But on average, there are, well, at least six or so workers in and around the forge area. Whether they're working on the furnace or working on the forge is not always clear. By the 19th century, we know that the workers of Derwent Coat lived in a row of small cottages near the forge with their families. And we know this from the census documents that we have. We would have had at least a small community of about a dozen people at its lowest, up to about 40 people at its highest. And many of those, of course, would have worked in the forge or in the furnace, but there are other professions there as well. So, for example, we know that there was a carpenter there. We know that there were builders there. We know there are farmers there, miners, people working in the quarries, and indeed plenty of children as well.
And what were the conditions like for these workers? Was it dangerous?
Well, it's certainly hard physical work. You're loading and unloading charcoal, heavy bars of iron, in and out of quite a cramped space. And when the furnace fire is lit, you have to keep it at the same temperature. And that means stoking and tending the fire continuously for both ends for days at a time. It's probably going to be a dusty atmosphere. It's going to be very hot. The air quality is probably not very good, particularly in the long term for your lungs. So whether it's dangerous, I suspect that there's probably not huge amount of chances of accidents, but it's pretty hard work, let's say that.
So throughout the Georgian and Victorian period, it's a successful site. What are the main reasons for the site closing, though, eventually in 1891?
Well, we know that the forge and furnace were abandoned in 1891, but we're not 100% sure exactly what happened or when. But the general picture of the steel market gives us something of an insight into what might have happened. So the first thing to think about is that the same location that essentially feeds the productivity of Derwent Coat by this point is actually constricting. So the river, which provides you with power, as I said earlier, is also unnavigable, but your competitors in Sheffield have a state-of-the-art canal system which is able to import your raw materials and export your products. And the capacity of Sheffield is much, much greater than places like Derwent Coat in the mid to late 19th century. Also, the technology starts to move on. I mentioned the fact that Derwent Coat introduced a crucible steel furnace in the mid 19th century. Now, the crucible process can be used to produce more of a finished product than what comes out of the blister steel. And thus, the cementation process is kind of going out of fashion in the 19th century. It's essentially superseded by methods like the crucible steel process. There's also other processes coming along in the 19th century, such as the Bessemer process. And these are far more efficient and ultimately cheaper to produce steel than cementation. And at this time, increasingly, steel is being produced in other countries, such as the US. As a result of a greater viability of different sources of iron. So in all, cementation is pretty much redundant by the end of the 19th century, albeit it still goes on in Sheffield to produce some sort of niche products.
When did English Heritage then become custodian of Derwent Coat steel furnace?
Well, the people of Derwent Coat do stay into the 20th century. There is some coal mining that takes place in the vicinity of the forge, but the cementation furnace essentially goes into ruin until it was bought by the Department of Environment and placed in English Heritage guardianship in 1985. At this point, there's a program of research, and English Heritage sets about consolidating and repairing the furnace, which is pretty much derelict by this point. The furnace itself is okay. It does need a bit of TLC, but the ancillary buildings have lost their roofs and need some quite considerable structural work. And then so after this long period of research and consolidation, the site opens to the public in 1991.
How does the site look now then compared to Derwent Coats' heyday?
Well, today the area is ostensibly a woodland. If you walk down from the car park towards the furnace, you're kind of a little bit surprised to sort of see it emerge out of the woods, I think. And I think the cementation furnace looks quite like it would have done when it was in operation. They've done a really good job of restoring it. And I think it's a really characterful building. It's kind of quirky. It's asymmetrical. It's built on a slope. So it's a little bit odd. But what I think I find most compelling about it is it proudly wears the scars of its service. So since it was subjected to these very high temperatures, the stonework is discolored, it's cracked in places from the expansion and the contraction. But 160 years of hard work, hard graft, haven't ruined its essential form. I always think that it looks tough enough to handle probably another 160.
And those workers' cottages you mentioned, how well do they survive?
Well, they were essentially lost almost because the forest sort of reclaimed the forge buildings and the workers' cottages. And unless you know where to look, it's actually quite difficult to locate them. There were excavations done there starting about a decade ago in order to kind of better understand these buildings, because we knew from the historical documentation, we knew from the mapping, broadly speaking, what was down next to the river. But we didn't know exactly what was where at what time and how they would have looked and things like capacity and things and how they related to each other. So in 2010, a time team actually excavated the area and they found part of the crucible furnace that we talked about that was installed in sometime in the mid-19th century. And then a little bit later, Newcastle University came along and looked in more detail at some of the workers' cottages and really kind of revealed how these had essentially been homes for people over a couple of centuries, and kind of revealed the kind of the domestic life, showing some of the features of these places, such as the fireplaces and etc.
Well, let's bring in volunteer manager Sophie Hearn into our conversation. We've heard a lot now about the history of Derwent Coats steel furnace, Sophie. How can we get to the site? Andrew has already mentioned a car park, so clearly you can drive there. So could you give us a bit of an idea of how we can visit?
Yeah. So Derwent Coats is one of our free to enter sites, and the grounds and woodland walk are open all year round. So you can explore. The only point to note is that if you would like to get into that interior furnace building that Andrew so brilliantly described, you can only do that through our guided tours. So please do check our website where we've got a tour schedule. And yeah, we've got a car park. It's not managed by English Heritage, but it is very close by. And it's a lovely walk down the valley into Derwent Coats. And the grounds of Derwent Coats are a little bit uneven. Not be suitable for wheelchair or pushchair users, but we do have new wayfinding signage, so you can quite easily find your way to the cottages, to all of those other buildings, right the way down to the river, where the walk ends with a lovely bench with a carved face of a old man who we like to tell visitors used to work in the furnace building and has decided to retire at the end of the woodland walk and has turned into one of the trees that has now taken over the site.
Oh, very artistic. Okay, very good. If you're coming, then obviously you might want to bring some good solid footwear.
Yeah, some good solid footwear. We do have some walkways, wooden platforms, raised platforms to make that woodland walk a little bit more accessible. But yeah, definitely your walking boots and some good waterproofs as well, because it always seems to rain in the Derwent Valley. But yes, it's a lovely walk. It's very very natural and nice to be around all of the woodland and all of the wildlife that's there. And we quite often see herons and red kites. So there's more than just the industrial heritage. There's also the natural that you can go and enjoy. And it's a very peaceful place to explore.
Yes, I can imagine. These guided tours then that you mentioned, obviously these are put on at certain times. Can you tell us when the next one is?
Yeah. So our guided tours are all free to join and they are led by our wonderful volunteer guides. They run throughout the year. We have a few more on during the summer for obvious reasons. but you can just go on the English Heritage website and search for Doe and Coat, and there will be a schedule. We update it every 3 months, and we're actually at the point where we're going to update it for January, February. So by the time this podcast comes out, there will be some dates there. They're usually on weekends, Saturdays and Sundays, and the meeting point is just at the entrance to the site. There's no need to pre-book. You just turn up on your date and time and enjoy.
Okay, so broadly speaking, if you're listening to this when it comes out, which is wintertime 2021, you can go and visit the woodland and the outside areas quite easily. But if you want to go inside, you probably have to wait until the spring. Is that right?
Yeah, till January, February. That's when our next list of guided tours is going up on the website. Yeah.
Now, it's really important, obviously, that this site continues, and it does so through the help of volunteers. So do you have any other volunteers supporting you and the overall operation there?
Yeah. So Doe and Coat's a really interesting site. We have quite a diverse volunteer group there. So we have something that's called our affiliate volunteer scheme. And this is where groups and friends groups can support a local English heritage site with their gift of time and skills. So they effectively help to care for the places that they love. And at Doe and Coat, our affiliate group is the Volunteer Woodland Team. They are a legacy group that were first established by the Land of Oaknine Partnership and are now supported by the Durham Wildlife Trust. And they help us to care for that woodland, to help ensure that that lovely woodland walk is accessible. They help to make sure that the habitat is good for all of the lovely animals that live down there. And they also clear the vegetation away from some of the industrial features so that you can see them and you can enjoy them. And they're a fab team. We also have our own volunteers, so English Heritage volunteers, and they help in a range of ways. So we've got our monitor volunteers, and they help to care for the physical buildings. They make regular checks, they complete reports, and they send it back to the Free Sites team. They also help with litter picking, site presentation, clearing away leaves, and making sure the signage is all correct and in place. And they also make checks on behalf of our estates team to keep the facilities running at site, so the electrics and the water. Mm-hmm. And we also have wildlife survey volunteers. This is a relatively new role, but they go out, they watch for a few hours what they see, and they record it, and then they send it to our landscapes team, who are able to use that information to develop a better picture of the ecosystem. And then just to top it all off, we also have photography volunteers who go out and they capture the industrial and the natural beauty of Doe and Coat as it changes through the seasons. So there's a big, big team that helps to care for Doe and Coat. Yeah.
A multi-layered team with lots of different areas of knowledge and expertise and interests as well, by the sounds of things. So you're well stocked. Do you need any more volunteers, dare I ask?
So we are well stocked, but we're always looking for more people to join our friendly team. So we'll be recruiting for volunteers in early 2022. And that's not just at Doe and Coat, but that's across all our properties in the north. So if you are interested in volunteering, just go on the English Heritage website. There's a volunteer page there, and you can search by postcode or you can search by site. So if you have a particular site that you love, such as Doe and Coat, just type it in and it'll bring up all of the opportunities that are available there for you to get involved in.
You're obviously very familiar with the site yourself. What do you enjoy most about Doe and Coat Steel Furnace site from a visitor's point of view?
Yeah, so I think from a visitor's point of view, it's all of the hidden corners. Every time I go to the site, something gets pointed out to me that I've never seen before, I've never noticed before. It's constantly something new. So even if you visited Doe and Coat one time and one time only, or if you visited 50 times, there's always going to be something different every time you go. And I think it's also just really important in terms of the industrial history of the North and the Northeast, especially. You know, everyone, if you come from the Northeast, everyone has a story of the shipyards or the industry. And it's just really nice to go to places like this and to see how people lived back then, see how things worked back then. And you just wouldn't imagine, with how natural the valley is now, that it was once such a buzzing industrial place. So I think it's the unexpected, really, for Doe and Coat.
Yes, we've made the same comment on a previous podcast about the Iron Bridge in Shropshire, that being such a very different place in its time and how it's now very much picture postcard, similar to Derwentcote. Andrew, you're listening to all this, and you and I, obviously, we do a lot of podcasts about Roman feats of engineering, but Derwentcote's got its own attractions as well, hasn't it, from an engineering perspective?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing I need to do is to assure you that I will be back talking about Rome soon enough. I think one of the nice things about English heritage is that we care for such an array of different sites and thus speak to sort of this myriad of stories of England's past. It's a real joy to be able to change tack and examine some of the other threads in that rich tapestry in order to find sort of surprising connections and differences and gain new perspectives on the past. I think that what really grabs me about Derwentcote is that it's a place only just out of living memory. And the details are perhaps a little bit sharper to me than say, speaking about Rome, which can be both sort of tantalizing and frustrating. With Derwentcote, sort of the hues of life are really well defined. Sophie joked that we have the sculpture that we tell people is of a retired steelmaker. Well, I can tell you that in 1851, a man called George Eltringham was living at the workers' cottages, and he was a retired steelmaker who had been the steelmaker there at the time of the previous census in 1841. So we can really pull out those little details. We also have this complete characterful building, which is so evocative of where ordinary people worked and what ordinary people did, which is quite rare for Roman Britain. And I think more broadly as a society, we often overlook the significance of our surviving industrial heritage, and particularly how diverse and how distributed it is. It crops up throughout Britain in places that you wouldn't necessarily expect to find it. And our industrial heritage profoundly shapes the fabric of modern-day Britain. It's not just, you know, the factories or the ports of cities like, you know, Newcastle or Sheffield, but it's also the graft and technical expertise of tiny communities like Derwentcote that put places like the northeast of England at the forefront of the industrial revolution.
Yes, so that was going to feed in really into my last comment, really, which was, you know, it sounds like it had a really important part, however small, in the broader industrial revolution and how it relates to the England and industry that we've inherited today.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's really key to where Derwentcote is. It's right in the middle of what we call the Land of Oak and Iron, which is a project that's been happening for quite a few years now and is now a trust. And that largely covers the Derwent Valley, Consett, Rowlands Guild, Prudder, Wickham, all of these kind of hinter regions that actually back in their heyday were so, so important to what was happening elsewhere, and not even in the country, but also in the world. So it's a lovely little place. And if anyone is on the A1 going up to the north, please do take a little detour and have a little explore.
Yes. Thank you, Andrew and Sophie, for talking to us. Really interesting site. And hopefully people will come and visit for those guided tours next year.
Yes, absolutely. We look forward to seeing everyone to come and see the site and share it with them.
You've been listening to the English Heritage Podcast. Next week, we'll hear about the preparations taking place for winter solstice at Stonehenge.
It obviously has huge amounts of religious meaning for people today, but it's also a completely unique World Heritage Site and ancient scheduled monument. You know, this is a place we should be protecting for the future. So, yes, respect the stones is a really important message.
Thanks for listening. See you next time.